Welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I'm joined by Don Corder, who is Jim Corder, the founder of Corder Drums, on the show. Don, welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so Corder is one of those really cool brands that I think a lot of drummers know about, but it's got a unique history. First off, this was recommended by Brian Bayer, who I believe you emailed back and forth a little bit, and Brian has done a lot of research on the drum forums and tried to put together a little bit of the history himself, and we kind of figured, why not go to the man himself, Mr. Don here? So yeah, Don, why don't you go back and tell us about the origins of Corder? And I'll spell it out for people. It's Corder. There's connections to Fibes. There's acrylic drums. There's all kinds of cool stuff. So tell us about Corder Drums.
Okay. Well, Corder Drums was basically my dad. When he was young, he was pushed off the steps of the school where he went to school, and he bruised his heel, and he got tuberculosis of the bone in his heel.
Oh, my God.
And I don't know if you're familiar with that disease or not, but he was bedridden for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
And his leg, basically, his hip just disintegrated. So he had a built-up shoe, probably 6 inches and on one leg. And you know, he never considered himself handicapped at all. And so when he was in, I think in high school, he ordered a drum set. And back then there was no local music store. You know, he ordered it from Ludwig, I think, and started playing the drums. He worked his way through college. He had no help from his mom. He was a single, you know, didn't have a husband at the time. Mm-hmm. His dad had passed away from tuberculosis.
Jeez. What year was he born? And just so we know that.
He was born in 1921.
Okay.
Yeah, he worked his way through college playing the drums with a big band.
Cool.
You know, they would play all these gigs, and he would actually made enough money to send money home to his mom. And so when he got out of college, he opened a music store. He was just into music. He liked music, but he was a businessman. That's what he got his degree on in college.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, continued to play drums. We moved back to Huntsville. And then I think it was in the middle to late 60s. He had a retail store here also, because he had one in Tuscaloosa. And then he moved up here to Huntsville, and he opened up another music store. And then he started thinking about the acrylic drums, you know, plexiglass, plastics was big and coming on in the 60s.
Yeah.
And so he made a plexiglass drum. And I remember it was so far ago that I remember riding my bicycle over to where he was working on the drum. And it just didn't mean anything to me. I just kept riding my bicycle. And anyhow, he finished the drum and contacted Ludwig Drum Company about, you know, what kind of interest they might have in that drum. And according to my dad, he took it up and met with Bill Ludwig.
Wow.
And dad got behind the curtain and played one of Ludwig's snare drums, and he played his snare drum that he'd made. And Ludwig picked his snare drum as the better sounding one. He thought it was his.
The blind taste test kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so dad tried to work something out with Ludwig, but Ludwig, and dad actually had gotten a patent on what he thought was clear, you know, plexiglass drums. But at the time, Zico's, and I don't know who all else was involved in that. There was a bunch of people doing that at the same time.
Yeah.
And come to find out, the dad was pushing his drums as you could change inserts out. You could have a champagne sparkle one night and a blue, you know, sparkle the next week. You just take the head off, put a different insert.
That is, so I was looking into that a little online, and that is, to me, just such an awesome idea. Like, I mean, so you just explained it really well, but just for my own, you know, brain to wrap around it. So you basically, like you said, you take the head off, and then I guess there'd be little, you know, holes to kind of fit around the you know, the screws for the lugs. But yeah, you're changing it to, you have blue drums one night, then like you said, sparkle. I mean, that is such a good idea. Yeah. And you can only do that because they're clear acrylic drums and you can see through them. So it's just like,
correct.
Oh my God. I mean, I've never heard of that.
So that's what his patent was on.
Wow.
So he act when Ludwig started making the what, Vistalites or whatever, yep, the shaded colors.
Yep.
He tried to sue them, and there was a law firm in Atlanta that looked at it, and they go, no, you don't have a case.
Yeah.
We're sorry. You know, you just don't have a case. So, you know, years passed, and then Dad sold his music store and then found himself kind of floundering. He didn't know what to do. You know, he saw all the money going out and nothing coming in. Mm. So then he started a custom clear drum company and yes, started making plexiglass shells, and he would take people's drum sets if they wanted, he would change them over, drill the holes to match their hardware, and just basically change their whole shells out to acrylic shells.
Wow. So he would just use, like, if you have a Ludwig kit or whatever, he would use their hardware,
you know,
because online, yeah, there's some like forums and things people are talking about, like, gosh, that's like they look at these. I think there was some documentation about Custom Clear Drum Company, which is in, you know, obviously in Alabama, and they would say there's so much different hardware, which that makes perfect, yeah, sense, because it's just,
yeah, it was just whatever they had at the time and whatever Dad could come up with. If he made a drum set, it was made from just whatever he could scavenge.
Man,
you know,
he sounds like a very like a businessman, like you said, but also just like an inventor, like a very, like, well, I can, you know, like he got it done, you know?
Oh yeah. He's got, I looked through the patent file. I was trying to find the patent on the drums, the, yeah, interchangeable inserts, but I couldn't find it. I could find one on the flute lyre. I could find one on the, he had one for a bass drum with protective feet. Hmm. He had one on the music flip folder. He had several, you know. He tried to patent everything, and it never worked out for him, but that's okay. You know,
they got to have the guy who's doing it. I mean, there's something so impressive about that. And I briefly looked into, like, now I feel like it's a little different probably now versus then. I don't know which one would be easier or harder, but man, patenting anything is really not easy, and it's expensive and it takes time. And again, this is many years later in 2021, or at that point, I think it was 2020 when I was looking into it. But so good for him. I mean, he's covering all his bases,
yeah,
trying to,
yeah, protect it. He was a sharp fella.
Yeah.
Really.
Okay. So
better man than me is all I can say.
Well, that's great. I mean, honestly, that's awesome that your dad is such an important person to you. I'm just interested too about, and I think I was talking about this with, when I was doing the Zikos episode with Wes Falconer, who knew Bill Zikos, cause he's kind of known as the inventor of like the acrylic drum, which it sounds like that still sort of holds true. I know there's other people doing multiple things, but it seems like your dad was like, okay, other people are doing this. And I think there is usually like a two or three people can kind of be experimenting at the same time, and it's like who comes first to market sort of thing. So, but
right,
how, yeah, did your dad, like, was he working with a company who was manufacturing like a plastics manufacturer, or the actual production of the early acrylic, the Custom Clear Drum Company, which was the original company? I mean, how did he get these shells made? How did that, do you know how that went?
Well, he worked with a local plastic company. They had a, like a big furnace. They would put a sheet, and they would cut the sheet to the size for the height of the drum. And then they would put it in a big oven to heat it up to where it was pliable. And then they would roll it over on a, basically a mold. Hmm. which would be the inside diameter of, you know, the shell, basically.
Sure.
And so you had the outside diameter that would fit the head. And then you would bevel the edges where they came together, and then use some type of a cement to bond the two together. And you could actually buff that out and make it almost, you know, totally transparent. It would be sometimes hard to see where the seam was.
Wow.
And then you'd have to, you know, route the edges to make a good bearing edge on the shell.
Yeah. Now, do you, what did the badge, did he have like a nice badge that said custom clear
drum company? No, you know, when we had the drum company, we never had a badge. We didn't serialize any of the drums. We just made them, you know, we didn't know what we were doing, to be honest with you. We just did the best we could with what we had, and there was a sticker that we stuck on the drum, but there was no badge like where the tone hole is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
There was never a badge put on,
which makes you wonder like how many are floating around, just kind of like unlabeled, if you know what I mean. Like maybe there are people are thinking they're like a Japanese drum or something, when really they were from you guys.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's possible. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
So anyhow, when Dad had the custom clear drum come, he had a guy named Terry Cornett that came and worked with him. And Terry was a drummer. He still is a drummer. You know, he worked with the Huntsville Symphony, and he worked with Dad with Custom Clear Drum Company until Dad basically, you know, he was doing that, and then people knew he had a music store before, and they would come in and they'd go, you know, can you get me some guitar strings in? Can you get me this? Can you get me that? So he ended up just basically merging into a full music retail store again. And the Custom Clear kind of just floundered, just laid on the side. Yeah. So Dad was a Martin guitar authorized dealer. And so the Martin dealer knew that Dad piddled in drums. And one day he just asked him, he said, you know, we're making these drums and we're a guitar company and we're kind of wanting to get out of the drums. Would you be interested in buying, you know, the inventory? Hmm. Dad goes, yeah. You know, so they sent him a big list of the stuff that they had, and it was worth, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
According to what they had listed. And my older brother, Gary, was working with Dad at the store. He'd already graduated from college. And Dad said, I don't have the money. I don't have that kind of money to buy this. I would love to do it. And my older brother, Gary, says, make him an offer.
Yeah.
And he said, just lowball it. Make him an offer. They can refuse it or they can take it.
Yeah.
So Dad made him an offer, and by George, they accepted it.
Wow.
So it was in, I think, the early winter of 79 when they shipped that stuff down from Pennsylvania. Three tractor trailer loads.
Wow. And I mean, you know, we got to say too that it was Fibes. I mean, so they.
Yes, it was Fibes. Yes.
Yes. So,
but we weren't able to buy. We weren't able to use the Fibes names because Martin was still making drumsticks under the Fibes names, and they would not relinquish that name.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, that's okay. We were just wanting to make drums.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is a Fibes episode out there that people can check out with Tommy Robertson. So basically, C.F. Martin acquired Fibes in 1970-ish, if I'm not mistaken. But then they, so just to kind of, you know, reiterate all that, then they sold it to your dad, the drum, the equipment and like the tooling and just So he just now had basically like a drum factory.
Right. Yes.
In 1979.
I mean, the molds, the die casting dies to make all the lugs, the tom mounts, the floor leg mounts.
Wow.
Everything. And so we got that stuff, and we didn't have a place to put that. So we rented some space in the Huntsville Industrial Complex, or center, which was an old textile mill built in the 1800s, I think. Mm. It was old, you know.
Yeah.
And we were there probably 2 months, maybe, because I actually looked it up, and then it was in February of 1980. They don't know how it happened, but that mill caught on fire. We were in the basement. We were there. We had a solid slab of concrete above us, which the building sat on. And we were in the basement. Huh. And that building burned to the ground. And I remember going up to Dad's house. He kind of lived up on a hill that you could kind of look out over Huntsville. And we could see that thing burning.
Wow.
And I'm standing there, and these explosions happen. You know, you see something happen, and then all of a sudden you hear a big boom. And I go, well, there goes my acetylene tank, you know, because I had stuff down there that I was using to build stuff to. Yeah. We had to wall in an area. The whole area downstairs underneath that slab was just open. And you told them how much space you needed, and then you built a wall around the space that you rented. And it was kind of unique.
Yeah.
And so it burned to the ground. And because of that, Dad was eligible for a Small Business Administration loan. And we acquired a piece of property, or he acquired a piece of property, and built a building. 5,000 square foot building, which was packed the first day we moved in.
Wow.
It was, and then when I started acquiring machines to do the stuff that I wanted to do, to make parts, because that's what I did.
Yeah.
Dad was the president, you know, he was everything. Hmm. My older brother, Gary, was the numbers cruncher. When we were in production, he would go stand by whoever was doing what they were doing and time them. And really, wow. He came up with the prices of the things that
someone's got to do it.
We sold. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what he did.
Wow.
And then,
man.
And, I got to mention my younger brother too, Kim, my younger brother. He ended up doing all the lacquer finishes on the shelves. He got really good at that.
That's awesome. I didn't realize how much of a family. I mean, I knew it was your dad and you, but that's great. So it's awesome your brothers were involved as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Couldn't have done it without you know, everybody's help. And Terry Cornett, the guy I mentioned earlier, he came and worked for us.
Oh, that's cool.
And a guy named Bill Von Camp that Dad knew through the music store came and worked, and he's the one that started that actually ended up covering all the shelves, and he opened up a business later on after we sold, and was selling drum shells and covering and stuff like that. So
cool.
But me, I'm stuck back in my corner. I was just like where I was in school, basically.
Yeah.
And learning how to you cannot imagine how many parts, individual parts, go into making a drum and a drum set.
Sure.
It's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, really, to make and it so actually happen.
We basically had, you know, most of that stuff outsourced, and then I would go, Dad, if I can get this lathe, I can make this part. And so we started buying machines a little at a time, bought a milling machine. And I could make, I ended up making some dies to do the stamping
of
metal parts, part of the hoops, made things to make the snare hoop had a bridge on it. It wasn't just a cutout. It actually had a bridge on it because the Fibes throw off, which we ended up manufacturing, it kind of drops down quite a bit. So that bridge had to clear the edge of the hoop to allow the snares to drop down off the snare side of the shell.
Yeah, man. Well, let me ask you this. All right. So backing up before we get too far forward, I have two questions. All right. So the fire, that happened. Okay. But you guys, you said you were under that huge concrete slab. Was most of your stuff salvageable or was everything destroyed because you had that giant block?
It's weird. If we were close to a window, close to the outside, it's like a basement with a window up the top.
Yeah.
There was still enough heat that it would ignite it. The wall that with the plywood wall that we built caught on fire and burned just like a wick.
Yeah.
It just burned down. And so there were no wooden shells. There were a few plexiglass shells and they went up. You know, we had a lot of hoops that were underwater because we were in the basement and they're flooding water on everything they could to put it out.
True.
Well, it flooded. It flooded downstairs. Everything was pretty much. So we had a lot of tension rods. Diecast parts, lugs melted. Some of them were just in a big glob, an ingot, so to speak.
Yeah.
And, it was a mess. But it was a real mess.
Was the equipment cause your dad bought all that Fibes stuff. It's giant metal equipment. I mean, was it salvageable itself? The actual
Oh yeah.
Okay, so
yeah,
I was gonna say the Fibes stuff carried on.
We were able to salvage. We got two punch presses, OBI, which was drummers probably don't care anything about this, but OBI means just got an open back and it's clinable, so you can kind of tilt it back and parts would stamp and they'll just fall off. Okay. They'll fall off or shoot through the bottom of the die when you stamp parts.
Yeah,
those were fine. Those were fine. The machine that we got from with the company we would actually get blanks, hoop blanks, metal hoop blanks, like the triple flange hoop blanks, and we could set them on this machine and index them and flare them out to punch holes for 6, 8, 10, or 12 lug drums. And that needed a little bit of work after it, but it was, it was still totally usable.
Man, they built it to last. Fire and literally fire hose amount of water coming down. Wow. And then, all right. So my other question too, just to clarify for myself, just with the Fibes acquisition, did that get you guys shell manufacturing stuff, or was it really mainly just hardware manufacturing machinery, or was it everything? So were you creating then shells with the Fibes equipment?
It was pretty much everything. I remember they had a big apparatus, for lack of a better term.
Yep.
And it had pillar block bearings. It was 2 8-inch I-beams that were connected and long shafts from one I-beam to the other supported by pillar block bearings. And then on the end of that shaft was a big plate, aluminum plate, that you could mount different cylinders to that were made out of, aluminum. And that's what they used when they would make a fiberglass shell. They would put the mat in there and then spin it and start adding. I'm going by the way I thought they would have done it.
Sure.
Because I never saw it done.
Yep.
And then they would add the resin to it. And since it's being spun, like the centrifugal force would throw the resin out and you just keep spinning until it's set up. And that's how they made, I assume that's how they made the shells. We never got into that. Yeah. I think we ended up selling that to somebody, and I don't know why, but it was just in the way.
Well, I was going to, before we started, I was just going to say that we talked about how your dad didn't want to get involved with fiberglass.
That is correct. Yeah.
He said no, yeah. Which that seems like a lot of work. I think it just goes to show that it's awesome for the companies that did and do, but I get that your dad didn't want to get involved with fiberglass. So you guys were typically wood shells at that point. I'm assuming acrylic sort of.
Some acrylic. Yes.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah. But he was basically pushing the wood shells.
Yeah. So that makes sense. A little bit
they
easier.
They were easier to work with. Yeah. A lot easier. We would buy long tubes from a company who's no longer in business. I think Jasper Wood Products was the company that we got shells from the first time. And they made all kinds of plywood products, tables. I think, I don't know what all they made, but they could set up and make the shells, and they would.
Sure.
And we would get like a 16-inch diameter shell, maybe, you know, 36 feet or 36 inches long.
Yeah.
Or 32 inches long. So you cut it in half to make two 16 by 16 floor toms.
That makes sense. And then you're making all of the hardware and all that stuff to put on there out of all that you know, great equipment. You were there in the corner stamping things out.
Yes, I was in the corner, and that was my little world. I remember my brother, Gary, coming back there and timing me, and I'm standing there, and he just started laughing. He goes, "You don't even realize I'm here, do you?" And I startled. I go, "You know, no, I don't. I'm so involved in what I'm doing."
Wow.
That he just basically started laughing. So yeah, I was in my own little world back there, and I loved it. I loved it. I loved making new things. It was a challenge to me to make things. And
yeah, absolutely. It's neat to me too. To like if you look at a quarter drums, just to think that like how much hands-on stuff from your family, from the quarter family, is involved in these drums. It really makes it. You kind of look at them a little different. It's just a small American brand, in especially in Alabama. You don't really, I'm sure there's some others, but man, you don't hear of too many drum brands in Alabama.
Yeah, well, let me tell you what. Don't let this secret out. Alabama is a great state to live in.
Sure,
but we don't want anybody else coming here. we're getting enough people moving in.
Yeah.
The secret's probably already out.
Yeah. So
it's a great place.
That's good to know. This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at ForksDrumCloset.com. All right, well, let's get back on the timeline here. So... Your dad got your dad got the small business loan. You're in your new, we'll call it a factory. Take it from there. What year was that happening? The transfer over to the new after the fire.
Oh, it probably took about 8 months to a year to get the building done where we can move in.
Yeah. And there's that old saying about most businesses don't recover after a fire, like restaurants and stuff. So you guys, that was a real trial.
Yeah. Yeah. We weren't hurt too bad. Sure. The diecast dies were off of the diecaster up in the Northeast somewhere. I forget the name of that company.
Boy, that's convenient.
The things that actually made the major part of the things that we used on drums,
wasn't there.
They weren't even in house.
Yeah, that's lucky. So, man. All right, so carry on with the history there. What happened after that? And were you guys at that point, maybe we also talk a little bit about your public image and like, you know, how Corder was doing in the, cause you know, the whole goal is to sell the drums. So how are things going with selling and getting these things out in the world?
Well, that's what dad was. He was a salesman, and that's what he did. You know, he was all constantly doing that. It never ended,
yeah.
You know, never ended. He wanted to get into the marching band.
Oh, sure.
Line of drums. And so we got into that. And my older brother commented, we're making lots of money on the quads when we would make quads. He said, we're not making so much on the bass drums, but we're killing it on the quads. So
more quads.
Yeah.
That's great. It's a never ending market there, the marching band world.
Oh, and those folks can destroy a snare drum.
Really?
They crank it down to where you're like banging on a tabletop. I don't understand that, but I'm not a drummer, so.
Yeah. Well, that was one of my questions later was because a lot of people who work in drum manufacturing aren't drummers. So you yourself were not a drummer. I'm sure you've played the drums.
No, sometimes. But my older brother's was saxophone and keyboard, and I finally started playing the guitar a little bit. My younger brother played mandolin for a little while, but he hadn't picked that up in years. So we weren't really a musically inclined family.
Sure. Well, you're manufacturers and that's all, that's pretty important right there. All right. So, Corder, you know, as I'm seeing, it was going strong until about, in like 1990 ish. So what happened? So we were in the late 70s, 79. So, then take us through there. So the 80s were pretty good. What were some milestones along the way there?
Things were just, you know, to me, rolling smooth.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we were actually sitting at a table. I can't remember what we were producing. Dad walks up and his eyes are crossed and I'm going, what's up with that? You know?
Yeah.
He started having problems with, not his mental capacity at that time, but he started having things go wrong. And he just told me one day, in fact, he told me, but I've come to find out he didn't tell my older brother or my younger brother. He said, I got something going on. Mm. He said, I need to get out of this business. And, so then he pursued trying to get a buyer to buy the business. And we tried to keep it from all the employees, but they knew something was up. They would go, what's going on? We're not coming out with a new catalog. You know what? Something's going on. I didn't know what to tell them. So I just went back to my little corner and kept making parts.
And, oh, geez. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Come to find out, Dad, he died in 1999 of Alzheimer's. Mm. The last 6 months of his life, he couldn't, if he tried to speak, it was words you had never heard. He couldn't even speak the English language anymore. He would just make up words. And I don't know how someone with Alzheimer's can make up words, but he did. And it was very, really sad to see him go through that. And
yeah.
I do remember there was a guy that worked for us also for a little while, Artie Dean. And Dean's not his real name. It's Stutzenberger or something. I forget what it is. Marianne Ramsey, who was our secretary, she had to write the check. So she couldn't write a check to Artie Dean because that wasn't his real name. Mm. So she had to write the check to his you know, what was on his birth certificate, I guess, or Social Security card. Anyhow, he approached me. He was into this vintage stuff. And he said, can you make these tube lugs? And I go, I can make that. So he said, well, I can sell them if you can make them. So I started trying to make some of the tube lugs. And then dad, my brothers found out. They said, you can't do that. You know, you can't come in here and make something that we could sell. And so I felt bad about Artie because I told him we could do it, but I couldn't. So we started making snare drums with tube lugs.
Yeah, cool.
And I don't know if anybody else was doing that at the time or not. I really don't. I don't know, you know, what was in the drum market at that time. I was just in my own little world.
Yeah.
So we made tube lugs. We made the 6.5, 8-inch snares, 6.5, and the regular size snares. I think we made some piccolo snares out of tube lugs too.
Cool.
And that ended up being a pretty big hit.
Yeah.
Everybody's kind of started wanting tube lugs. And so that was the start of that, which I still do. I still make some tube lugs.
Oh, yeah. They're popular today. I mean, I even think of like in the mid-2000s, there was like a big boom with tube lugs. I mean, they are cool. I mean, they're really, really neat drums. What about, so in that, you know, let's say in the 80s, what about endorsees and stuff? I was looking earlier on, I think the Drummer World discussion, like the forum, and I think Bermuda Schwartz, you know, plays with Weird Al, I believe he said he was an endorser. What other endorsees, you know, people playing your drums did you guys have?
I think a guy named Barrett Deems was an endorsee.
Yeah, the world's fastest drummer, quote unquote, at some point in time, which I know is debatable. And Buddy didn't like that. I'm pretty sure Buddy Rich, but cool.
And another guy, and gosh, I can't remember his name. He went into the Guinness's World Book of Records for playing the drums the longest. I don't think he used one of our drums, but I think he used some of the sticks. Dad actually came up with a nylon tip, but it was a nylon sleeve.
Mm.
And that you could take a drum stick and run it through this. It's like a pencil sharpener. And it would cut it down to where the sleeve would fit on it. You just glue that, you know, because if you're doing a rim shot with a, you know, on a snare drum, sometimes your sticks would fray further up.
And
that was supposedly to keep the stick from fraying if you did a rim shot. So
smart. He's an inventor.
I don't know. He was. He really was. He saw a need and he wanted to come up with something to fill that void that wasn't there. So.
Yeah. But wow, and throw anything else out there, but really that 1979 to 1990, I mean, like you said, it's, you know, depending on where in 79, pretty much that's 10 years, 11 years, like really got going and a lot of ups and downs in a pretty short amount of time there. I mean, that is, to become a drum company that people are still talking about 31 years later after it, you know, went closed the doors. It's pretty amazing. That's, you should be proud of your family.
Yeah. Well, I am. I'm still trying to do things that our family started sometimes, such as the tube lugs, but
yeah,
I'm slowing down on that. I can't stand and buff a buffing machine.
Yeah.
For the hours it takes to do it anymore.
Yeah. I'm sure. So, you know, again, like I said, throw anything else in, and if I'm missing anything there in the 80s, but what happened with, towards the end there? I mean, I know, I remember with the Fibes episode, there was like a radio programmer, Sammy Darwin, right? I think he kind of took, he was the buyer, right?
Dad sold the drum company to Sammy Darwin. And, when they actually bought it, they drove over from Iuka, Mississippi. It was a 2-hour one-way drive every day.
Jeez.
They would hop in a car and take off and drive over to Huntsville and work all day and then turn around and drive back and to learn the process of what we were doing and showing them how everything went. And how, you know, how the process that we went through for making the drums.
Yeah.
And they did that until, as I remember looking, I went into business in 1991. So somewhere in that transition period was when Darwin finally came over with a bunch of trucks, and they loaded all everything up into those trucks. And I stayed there for a little while. I had all my stuff in another corner and walled off. I said, this stuff doesn't go. And,
wow.
I had one little screw machine that I had personally bought that I made, threaded inserts, you know, the inserts that go inside the die cast lug.
Sure.
I bought the cams to do that part. And that was amazing, to watch that machine, because it would drill, and then it would center drill, and then tap the part, and then turn the outsides down to a threaded insert and part it off, and it would do one every 14 seconds.
Wow.
And that machine just sat there and ran, and it still runs in my shop the same way. Just that's what I make the post for the tube lugs on, is that machine now.
Man, sometimes you look at this hardware and you forget that, like, well, a lot of times now it is like just a robot or something, but you forget that the threading and the buffing is done by a person.
It's just
amazing. So you were doing your own thing there. If they sold everything else, so you were doing, hardware, obviously for quarter, but in the, you know, 90 and on, then did you continue making drum hardware on your own? And I know you said you're still kind of working on it. I mean, what's the story with that?
Just the tube lugs, which is only a brass, you know, sure. A brass tube lug.
Yeah.
I really didn't have a source to sell anything else. And a lot of that stuff's hard to make. You know, the die cast parts, you got to build a die casting die and have a company that run it for you. Cause you can't run that stuff in house unless you got a big shop and a big place to put a big die cast machine.
Yeah. Sure.
So,
yeah. Wow. And you're still selling them, correct? You can still buy, people can buy tube lugs from you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I make them. I had one guy, he thought my prices were a little high, which I don't think they are, but, you know,
yeah,
he asked about a size, and I said, where else can you get that size made?
Sure.
You know, I can make them any size you want.
Yeah.
Up custom. To 15 inches long, from 1 inch up to 15 inches, anything in between. And, I don't think China's making that. They'll make certain sizes, you know, and sell those certain sizes, but for a custom length drum or tube lug, I don't know anybody else that was doing it. There may be. I'm sure there are.
Yeah, of course. But it's cool. It's just because it's you and it's got the history. And you know, I'll say that people can go to Corder, Corder products.com, and you know, you can keep Don busy in his corner.
Yeah. Well,
making some of those tube lugs. Wow.
Thank you, Bart.
Yeah. Jeez. What an unbelievable story. I mean, it had to be pretty upsetting to sell this brand. I mean, obviously your dad faced a situation where he kind of had to, and it seemed like
he knew there was no future for him. You know, that's just sad to say. My older brother had actually gone back and gotten his mechanical engineering degree. Mm. So I guess he saw the writing on the wall. And my younger brother went back and got his degree in finance. And I went back to the school of hard knocks and just didn't do anything except learn to keep my hands greasy on working on machines and stuff like that. So,
boy, but you guys... You learned because of this drum company. Or you kind of like, you learned what
absolutely.
You could
I do. Learned so much. If I knew then what I know now, oh, it'd been Katie bar the door, because there's no telling what we could have been making. And yeah, it was a great, absolutely great learning experience for me.
That's awesome.
And yeah.
Wow.
Just eBay wasn't out at the time where you can go on and buy tools to put on these machines to make the parts. That place is, I've tooled up my machines through buying stuff off eBay, really.
Wow. Yeah, so, these old, I'm sure there's, everything's worth something to someone. You know what I mean? We're like, if you come across stuff like that, you can always part it out. And then guys like you who need that one thing.
Oh.
Wow. Fascinating.
Knurling tools, you know. Oh, gosh, yeah. Mm. Die casts or the die heads to do the threading of an outside, screw.
Sure.
It's great.
Well, so, you know, I still think that your dad's idea about those inserts, did anything ever come of that? Like, did any of those exist out in the world? Because I think that obviously it'd have to be done right, where they're not like sliding off or like they have to be connected correctly. But did anything ever come of that?
No, nothing ever came of it that I know of. Because really, to do it right, you would have to take one head off. And then you would have to go in there and take all the screws out.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
And then put the insert in, and then everything match up with the holes match up with your insert, your new blue sparkle or whatever, to match up with the hole pattern for the screws. And it was labor intensive to change out an insert.
Obviously, it would look a little different than if it was a nice blue sparkle wrap on the outside. So you'd have to play with your what finishes look great and all that stuff. So I'm sure there'd be a lot of. It's cheaper than buying a new drum set in a different color. You right. know?
Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And you could also put lights in one. You could do Christmas lights. You could do anything. You know, I don't know if Dad's patent, which has expired years ago. If anything like that could be done, or you could do, somebody with an artistic mind could make a drum set just shine.
Exactly. So that'd be awesome. Cool. Well, Don, this is all fascinating, and I want to let everyone know who's listening. Don is going to be kind enough to do a Patreon, the bonus episode that we do on the show. And we decided that it'd be fun to talk about catalogs with Corder, and because I think that's an interesting sub, we didn't really talk much about that, and it's you're putting your best foot forward and you're presenting your drums in the best light in this catalog, and I'm sure it's behind the scenes always a little chaotic and some funny things can happen there. So if you want to check out that and then many other bonus episodes, go to drumhistorypodcast.com and there's a become a patron button. So you can go there and check it out. And Don and I will record that episode right after we finish this one here shortly. But Don, I want to thank you for being here and sharing your family's story with me. You should be very proud. And your dad, Jim Corder, just seems like a great businessman who... his legacy is still going strong today. So, and then also Brian Beyer, Beyer. Thank you so much for connecting me with Don and emailing and all that good stuff. So Don, yeah, thank you so much for being here.
No, you're welcome. It was a pleasure to share what little information I had. So yeah,
it was great.
Thank you.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.